on term limits and whether they're consistent with the views of the founders, and you'll hear more about all that in just a moment. I'd like to introduce our moderator for this debate, Judge Will Garwood of the Fifth Circuit right here in Texas. Judge Garwood is an alumnus of the University of Texas Law School and has served as an associate justice on the Texas Supreme Court before serving on the Fifth Circuit, before being appointed to the Fifth Circuit right here in Austin. Judge Garwood?
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here at this fine conference, and I think that you will find this afternoon that we have got a very interesting program for you. This will be a very interesting debate on the subject of term limits for legislators, and I think more particularly for members of the United States Congress. Speaking in favor of term limits will be Honorable William Crystal, Chief of Staff to the Vice President. And speaking against will be Professor Nelson Polsby, of the Director of the Institute of Governmental Studies and Professor of Political Science at Cal Berkeley. We're going to allow them each about 10 or 12 minutes or so to open, and Mr. Crystal will open and be followed by Mr. Polsby, Professor Polsby, and then about 2 or 3 minutes each for rebuttal. Of course, this question of term limits is certainly not just one question. I think there are legal questions and policy questions that are involved. How would term limits be imposed on United States congressmen and senators? Would that take a constitutional amendment or not? And if it would, how would you get such an amendment? And that involves all sorts of things like the qualifications clauses and the time, place, and manner clause of the Constitution, 10th Amendment, those arguments. And then aside from the legalities of it, there's the question, is it a desirable thing to have those term limits or not? And we'll hear some good debate from that. And after these people close, they are open to questions and welcome. So I'll start off now by calling on Mr. Crystal.
Thank you, Judge Garwood. Gene Meyer, the director of the Federal Society, told me when I arrived a couple of hours ago that the sessions so far have been extremely philosophical and thoughtful. And so it's lucky we're here to lower the tone and not to say relieve the tedium. No. It's a joke that we'll manage to do both, perhaps lower the tone and increase the tedium, which would be bad. The second person I saw after I came in, after Gene, was Nelson Polsby. You have to understand that in the political science profession, which I used to be part of, he has a reputation not only obviously as a first-rate political scientist, but as a particularly effective and indeed ferocious debater. And no sooner had he seen me and sort of walked up to me, the first words out of his mouth were, "You're going first." So here I am. I do want to also congratulate the Federalist Society, one of my favorite organizations, for inviting Nelson Polsby. It shows the Federalist Society's commitment to all points of view, to having them aired at your conferences. Someone once, a friend of mine once described the Federalist Society as embodying the spectrum of all points of view about the law, all the way from Bob Bork to Nino Scalia. this is, however, false, since you go beyond Nino Scalia to Lino Graglia, Your Honor. You're a distinguished professor here. Let me try to be brief and explain why I think term limits are a good idea, and let me begin with a very brief historical anecdote. In 1978, when I was just finishing graduate school, Proposition 13 was on the ballot in California. And I was finishing my thesis, PhD thesis, a good part of which was on the Federalist Papers. And I was inclined to be against Proposition 13 because I thought, based on my reading of the Federalist and my studying of American politics, that initiatives or propositions were a bad way to make policy. Federalist defends representative democracy, and as you know, on the whole, against popular or participatory direct democracy. And but I was convinced I was wrong, and I really do think I was wrong, and Proposition 13 was right for the times, by an article actually written by my father, which had whose title was the following. The title, I recall this, the Wall Street Journal, was Proposition 13, A Populist Remedy for the Diseases Most Incident to Populist Government. Obviously playing off of Madison's famous phrase in Federalist 10. I do think that's a model, whether or not this particular argument was correct, a model for how to think about contemporary debates in the spirit of the Federalist. One can't slavishly adhere to the particular conclusions the authors of the Federalist came to. Circumstances are awfully different. An awful lot has changed since then. But one can try to think seriously about politics in the same way as Madison and Hamilton and Jay, and guided by their general understanding. The point with my father's making about Proposition 13 is, in the best of all worlds, perhaps you wouldn't have initiatives, but with all the developments of the last 100 years, the development of the welfare state, the difficulty of citizens having control over the legislators taxing them, that perhaps, not just perhaps, but probably, that this particular initiative was ultimately good for not just the economy, but for American politics. I think the same is really, I'd make a parallel argument for term limits. I'm not sure in the best of all democracies that one would want to have term limits or term limitations for legislators, but I think in the current American democracy, as it now exists, it would be a good thing. Let me briefly explain why. I think there are three really core arguments, and I'll just quickly sketch them. I don't think they'll be very foreign to most of you. For why term limits would contribute to good government. And I try to do these in the spirit of the Federalist, recognizing, and we should all recognize, those of us who are well disposed to term limits, that the Federalist puts a great weight on experience, on wisdom and prudence, on the need for capable and experienced, in fact, legislators. And so I do think it's fair to begin with a bit of a presumption against term limits on the basis of the Federalist. They considered it, they rejected it, and they make arguments that to some degree that explain why they rejected it. I think those arguments would be outweighed in their minds today by perhaps these three considerations. First, the development of the welfare state, broadly speaking, has created the famous iron triangle, if you want to call it that, of Congress, the bureaucracy, and the interest groups, which I think has changed the character of the Congress and of the political system. It is simply, with the welfare state and the government doling out of benefits, and with Congress as the keystone of that system of doling out benefits, and taking care of constituents and constituencies, the old separation of powers doesn't quite work the way it used to. That is to say, if you read the Federalist, the separation of powers is a device for the protection of liberty. It's part of the argument for limited government. The powers will check each other and prevent any one power from intruding upon another power's power, but also from intruding upon the citizenry. I think that was the argument and the expectation, and the powers set up to do that. You can make an argument that today the separation of powers does not really work that way, or doesn't work that way all the time, or often enough, that in a certain sense the different powers or parts of them can almost conspire together against the public, or that's too strong, but let's say without regard to the general views and general interest of the public. That, you know, congressional committees, the bureaucracies in Washington, or around the country for that matter, and the interest groups work together in a way that insulates them from the public. The powers cooperate rather than checking one another. All the benefits the government gives out with modern big government, welfare state government, makes it possible to buy off particular constituencies, particular interest groups. And it's very hard to cut through that Gordian knot. I think that's one way of describing the frustration citizens out there feel at the unresponsiveness of Congress or the political system as a whole. Term limits would help, it wouldn't do the whole trick, but it would help to cut through that Gordian knot by removing those legislators, precisely those legislators whose seniority is key to the preservation of that iron triangle. It's the senior legislators, the committee chairman, the ranking members on the committees, whose power is at the base of the sort of derivative power of the interest groups who support them and the bureaucrats who are terrified of them as they work together to dole out benefits and keep various, you know, make sure no government program ever dies and make sure no bold idea is ever implemented. So I think, you know, term limits really, I'm sure Nelson Bosby will give us lots of statistics that shows that there's more turnover than we think in Congress, but the question really isn't whether one representative serves for 4 years and moves on or is replaced by another two-term representative. The question is the long-serving committee chairman and subcommittee chairman. And term limits, quite effectively really, goes right at that keystone of the current, of the Iron Triangle, which in turn is, I think, at the heart of the welfare state and at the heart of some of our discontents today. This one argument that I won't bother rebutting all the counter arguments now, but one argument is that, gee, if the congressmen get moved out, the rest of the Iron Triangle stays in place and the congressional staff's power is even greater. I think that's empirically simply not so. I mean, anyone who's worked in Washington knows that the staff of long-term incumbent congressmen is more powerful than the staff of rookie congressmen, even if those staffers themselves have been around a long time. The staffer's power is derivative precisely from the congressman's power as a ranking member or a committee chairman or subcommittee chairman over a particular bunch of programs. So I don't in fact think the staff part would rejoin this argument if Nelson wishes, but I don't think the staff argument is actually true. So the first argument I think is that term limits is a pretty good way of getting at the kind of paralysis, the big, weak, somewhat paralyzed government that we produced as a result of the welfare state. Second argument is incumbency. You know, the facts are pretty well known. In the 100th Congress, 7 congressmen died and 6 were defeated in general election, much less turnover than in the old Politburo, let alone the new one. If there is one, I guess there isn't one, thank God. Incumbents have all these huge advantages, $112 million for sending those important letters you get from them all the time, giving you an unbiased view of how they're doing. But I would say this, that the reason for going after incumbency is not simply, and I do think that in fact, so the advantages of re-election, the deck is stacked, especially if they can control have some say on controlling the redistricting process, it just turns out to be very, very hard to get rid of, to run against incumbents. And I think in general, in a democratic system, one wants to have an open field and a fair chance for newcomers, whether in primaries or general elections, to challenge incumbents. But I think this argument really goes beyond the general preference for a more open system. I think, and this is an important argument, which is hard to prove, I think that in fact with term limits we would have higher quality people in Congress, but more capable legislators. This is an important consideration, and it's one I think that is not addressed enough by either the proponents of term limits or the opponents of term limits. That is, all these other institutional arguments are, you know, iron triangle, advantages, incumbency, are pretty important, but if you could show me that term limits would really result in just less able, less capable, less experienced, less responsible people running for Congress, I think I would tend to oppose it, because at the end of the day, the quality of legislators, you know, is terribly important. I mean, it's perhaps more important than these institutional devices. Madison says, I think it's Federalist 57, that the aim of every political constitution is or ought to be first to obtain as rulers men who possess the most wisdom to discern and the most virtue to pursue the common good of society. Does term limits increase the chances of obtaining men and women with the wisdom to discern and the virtue to pursue the common good of society? I think so. I think the current system, which prevents you, especially in the House of Representatives, from achieving significant power until many years have gone by, is an encouragement to what the political scientist, I guess the journalist actually, Alan Ehrenhold, it's called The Politics of Ambition. It's a discouragement to people who have accomplished something elsewhere in life, really, running for Congress because they think they'll have to stay there for 10, 15, 20 years before they can really accomplish anything. I think if you had more turnover of incumbents and less advantages, fewer advantages for seniority, which you'd obviously have, I think, if they had a 12-year cutoff, you would attract, you know, more genuinely first-rate people to run for Congress and not have, there are some there now, but there are too many mediocrities, many of whom are there much too long. So first argument, iron triangle. Second argument, incumbency. Third and last argument, I would make a pretty intangible one, but I think the culture, if you will, of Congress and the culture of our politics would change with term limits. The spirit of a political system is important. You know, the general sense of openness, a certain amount of boldness, a certain amount of responsiveness, courage. You know, individuals are who they are, but they become more or less courageous depending on the system they find themselves in, the culture they find themselves in. I have a sense that the current system, in all of its parts, and one part of it is almost assured re-election and incumbency and seniority, that the current system does not bring out the best, if you will, in the people in it, does not bring out the best in the American people, who tend to feel disaffected and often rebellious, sullen, kind of sullen rebellion. They can't really do anything about it. They take it out in sometimes silly ways, etc. I think greater turnover, which term limits presumably would produce, would be a breath of fresh air for the system. And while I think it would actually improve the real performance of Congress, I think more important, perhaps, it would improve the overall, if you will, political culture of the country in a way that's hard to measure, but really, I think, very, very important to the future of our liberal democracy. Thank you.
Bill, before I'm calling on Professor Polsby, I do want to stress my neutrality in this endeavor. We all went out to lunch, and I thought I'd show them some good, typically Texas food. I want everybody to have a chicken fried steak. Well, Bill wouldn't even try it, so I was immediately firmly against term limits. Then Nelson tried it and said he didn't like it, so now I'm all for it.
Well, it's nice being here with you. In the past, I've found the Federalist Society a wonderful group to talk with. And I'm going to impose a little bit on the seriousness and thoughtfulness of your discourse in the interest of having a little fun. I'm going to do a little arm waving and one thing and another. Since I've got the unpopular side, I realize I've got a tough job ahead of me. Even tougher seeing I had remembered that Bill was real smart, and I'm afraid I haven't changed my mind. It's tough appearing on a platform opposite one of the matinee idols of all right-thinking, young paleo, neo, and just plain conservatives. I feel as though I've wandered into an old-time movie set where I must upstage the political equivalent of the offspring of Lionel Barrymore and Ethel Barrymore. And this afternoon, in fact, I have reason to believe that Bill Kristol is bringing not only the famous family profile, but certain political opinions that sound like they might have been genetically programmed as well. I suspect this because it seems to me all the good reasons are lined up on the other side, but we will see about that. I'm not going to reel off a whole bunch of arguments against limiting the terms of members of Congress that I will mention, but won't develop in any detail. They're perfectly good arguments, but probably better suited to a friendly or a neutral crowd. I can't resist mentioning them anyway, on the off chance that they will get under somebody's skin and provide us with a few moments of amusement, probably at my expense, but I'll take a chance at it. Everybody knows, for example, that it's going to take a constitutional amendment to install term limits unless the court decides to repudiate its Powell v. McCormick decision, which holds that the Constitution specifies qualifications for members of Congress to sit, having to do with age, citizenship, and residency, and that Congress may not add to that list. Someone here may wish to dispute this, since the facts of the Powell case aren't foursquare with term limits, but even the phalanx of juvenile zealots at the Wall Street Journal has assigned to this issue haven't been able to plausibly to circumvent Powell, and I suggest it's a waste of time. So, we have the spectacle of self-proclaimed conservatives, once again, as with school prayer and the desecration of the flag and balanced budgets and heaven help us line item vetoes, whining and squawking for a constitutional amendment, mainly because they don't seem to be able to prevail for a moment in the political arena. In this case, the problem seems to be that Democrats win most congressional elections. So what does the true conservative do but attempt to put in a fix with the Constitution to prevent this enormity in our political life? I say, go find a few more good candidates and win a few more elections. Everybody who takes the trouble to find out knows that the term limits movement of recent years started as a hobby in the office of Eddie Mai, a slick Republican political operator, and a hell of a nice guy, by the way. A few token Democratic dupes are out front, but this is the same medicine from basically the same folks who hated Franklin Roosevelt so much they put through a presidential two-term amendment to the Constitution. That, of course, was the days when presidents were mostly Democrats. Where I come from, New England, by the way, not Berkeley, California, being a conservative means having a decent respect for the political institutions and other institutions you inherit, and worrying, with James Madison, that an easily amended Constitution affords the people less protection from ephemeral majorities than is altogether wise. It embarrasses me to be making these points in the presence of people who profess to be conservatives. Moreover, most of the substantive arguments you hear for congressional term limitations are grounded upon phony statistics that conceal the actual turnover in the membership. The famous common cause numbers, 98 point something of those who stand for re-election are re-elected, are supposed to be evidence that individual members are no good. But suppose we read this number as evidence that members are doing a good job of representing their constituents. We have, in fact, quite a lot of collateral survey evidence that suggests that people, by very substantial numbers, do, in fact, like their own members of Congress. It is true that one of the reasons members are popular is that they communicate with their constituents, and they listen to their constituents, and they sometimes help their constituents out when these ordinary citizens have problems with their government. And all this at taxpayer expense. Well, why not? It's their job. It's in part how they inform themselves about the human consequences of public policy and of the impact government makes in the lives of ordinary Americans. If these ordinary Americans decide to re-elect their members of Congress, there are versions of democratic theory that argue that they should be allowed to do so. Perhaps this should be classed as an inalienable right, one that even a temporary majority as registered in a public opinion poll should not be able to give away. Notwithstanding all this, the actual turnover numbers are more than 10% a Congress. Mean terms of service have for 40 years or more hovered between 4 and 5, that is 8 to 10 years turns over half the House. In that time period, on two occasions, as many as 25% of members departed, and 3 times as few as 10% departed. Mostly, turnover between Congresses has been in the teens and 20s. I don't know whether these numbers are ideal or not. They seem to me to be within reason, given the need for some experience and continuity and institutional memory in any organization that does serious business. It does not seem unreasonable to me that roughly 25 out of 435 members who voted on the Persian Gulf Resolution were also present in the House to vote on the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. The most important argument, however, I leave until last. Term limits would cripple the ability of Congress, by which I mean elected members working collectively, to do its job properly of legislating and not legislating, appropriating and not appropriating, advising, consenting and not consenting, checking and balancing and legitimizing the acts of government. This follows from propositions that scarcely need defense in a serious discussion. Experience helps in the acquisition of knowledge. Knowledge is necessary to have influence in a complex system where measures require technical mastery. Legislation is complicated. Public policy requires knowledge. Influence over public policy requires knowledge, technical understanding, and experience. The fact that some members never acquire this knowledge is a ridiculous argument for requiring that none ever should. So in the end, congressional term limits merely empower lobbyists, congressional staff, bureaucrats, presidents, journalists, all those upon whose experience and guidance an inexperienced Congress would have to depend. Reducing the strength and the competence of Congress reduces the legitimacy of all the acts of government over which Congress is entitled to express an opinion. Given the diversity of people that our Constitution is required to serve, anything that reduces the legitimacy of our government strikes at our capacity to govern ourselves. Congressional term limitations, arising out of mean-spirited, short-sighted, historically ignorant partisanship, are capable of doing real damage to our fundamental constitutional order. Fortunately, they are unlikely to be enacted, and so we may amuse ourselves by listening relatively unperturbed to their advocates. Thank you very much.
That was unperturbed. What is perturbed? I'll make three very quick points. I always get worried when a liberal or a moderate, whatever else it is, starts telling conservatives out there that he's disappointed by their failure to be truly conservative. Being truly conservative always means, you know, being ineffectual, very respectful of all established liberal ways and orders, and not seriously challenging liberal dominance of any institution or of the political system. So I wouldn't be intimidated by the notion that, gee, it's, how could a conservative actually favor a constitutional amendment or legislative changes or even structural changes in the system? Why not? I mean, you know, there are a lot of changes that would, in fact, make things better. There are changes that Nelson favors that would, you know, through the party nominating process, which he's written eloquently about, that would make things better. And they need to be debated on the merits. On the merits, I think the key point, Nelson Posey's key point, turns out to be that somehow term limits will deprive Congress of the technical knowledge, understanding, mastery, et cetera, that they need to legislate or appropriate wisely. You know, this is an empirical claim, I suppose, that congressmen and senators who are there more than 12 years, you need to be there that long or something approaching that long to know enough to legislate wisely, or that the odds that if you've been there longer, you will be wiser or have greater technical mastery. The odds are that if you've been there longer, you'll be wiser or have greater technical mastery or greater knowledge or something than if you've been there less time. I just don't believe that's true. I mean, I will, you know, randomly pick five House members who've been there less than 12 years and five have been there more and take my chances on wisdom, knowledge, judgment, all the way down through technical mastery, with the possible exception of the kind of technical mastery of hiding grants for your own district in appropriations bills so that journalists and citizens don't know that they're there. But I mean, the notion that with all the staff and research institutes around it, that you need the technical mastery of serving there 20 years, frankly, strikes me as a weak argument. And, you know, no one's for kicking everyone out after one term. There's plenty of time to get the knowledge that you need to be a congressman. The political appointees run executive departments reasonably, some of them at least, reasonably competently, and they don't stay there for longer than 12 years, and I think that job is every bit as difficult as the job of being a congressman. The last point I would make is I'll just read one paragraph from the Federalist Papers so that this panel doesn't go by without such a pang of respect to Madison and Hamilton. In the paper, number 57 on the House of Representatives, in a very relevant passage, Madison writes that one circumstance, the fifth circumstance in this paper, that will prevent the House of Representatives from engaging in oppressive measures is that they can make no law which will not have its full operation on themselves and their friends, as well as on the great mass of the society. This has always been deemed one of the strongest bonds by which human policy can connect the rulers and the people together. It creates between them that community of interest and sympathy of sentiments, of which few governments have furnished examples, but without which every government degenerates into tyranny. If it is to be asked what is to restrain the House of Representatives from making legal discriminations in favor of themselves and a particular class of the society, I answer, the genius of the whole system, the nature of just and constitutional laws, and above all, the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom and in return is nourished by it. Really, one of the most striking developments, obviously, of recent decades has been the not just tendency, but the fact that the House of Representatives and the Congress has made a lot of laws which they cheerfully apply to the rest of America and do not apply to themselves. The very fact that they do that which Madison says really cannot happen in a healthy representative democracy suggests to me that something is wrong with such a with our representative democracy, and that something of a structural sort, since there have been plenty of appeals to them not to do this, something of a structural sort needs to be done to restore the kind of communion of interests and sympathy of sentiments between representatives and those who are represented. And I think term limits would go a long way towards doing that.
Well, rather than rest and call for a directed verdict, I'll make, I guess, three quick points. The Iron Triangle point that Bill made, it seems to me, won't change with term limits, excepting in one detail. The interest groups will become more powerful, a lot more powerful. It's true that the committee, that members' personal staff tend to have influence according to the influence of their member, but it's not quite so true of committee staff. They will increase greatly in power as compared with elected members. No doubt about that, it seems to me. The incumbency point is a kind of an interesting one. That is to say, you'll get more capable legislators on average, recruit them to begin with, if you can promise them that they can't have careers in Congress. It seems to me at least as logical to think that what will happen is that these people will constantly look to the outside for guidance about what comes next. That may mean doing what California legislators are now doing, which is to say seeking jobs as lobbyists. It might mean any one of a number of things, becoming more acquiescent, presumably, to an administration that might hire them. There is something of a kind of a test, it seems to me, the general proposition that people who are legislators only derivatively and seconded from other institutions are, in fact, not of as high quality as the ones who are not treated that way. The British Labour Party, for a long time, had a custom, essentially, of sending into Parliament people who weren't making it in the labor unions. These, on the whole, were not the higher quality people. And I think it's conceivable that you can see in some urban places in the United States, traditionally anyway, that the people who were sent to Congress from the urban machines were not always the top of the line as compared with the people they kept back in the herb to run the serious patronage system. So my view is such empirical evidence as we have suggests that Bill's suspicion is completely wrong about the caliber of people in a devalued legislature. I didn't understand his culture of Congress point. But I just want to close with an anecdote, but to me a kind of an appealing anecdote about whether it takes you time to get acclimatized to a complicated, I suppose the world's most complicated and most powerful legislature. There's a very good book that I would assign to all of you and to Bill about the political career of a young senator named Dan Quayle. It took him about 6 years before he got down to business.
Presented a good debate, and we now want to call on you to join in it or to ask questions. And do we have any questions for either speaker here? You might have to wave your hand because it's difficult for me to see back there. I think I have one over here. Come to the mic.
I just wanted to pick up on Nelson's challenge about challenging we Republicans to win more elections, which I think is great. I'm just wondering, the conventional wisdom seems to be that term limits are going to be our one-way ticket to finally get rid of liberal Democrats in Congress and take over, especially the House of Representatives, which we've been wanting to do, obviously, for many years. However, John Fund of the Wall Street Journal and a number of other commentators have recently documented the growing number of liberals who are embracing the term limit idea, examples being Jerry Brown, Shirley Chisholm, Ralph Nader. Not our friends, needless to say. People who see this as a way of removing moderate and conservative Republicans from Congress, the Strom Thurmonds, the Bob Doles, our friends, Phil Crane on the House side, all sorts of people who've helped us over the years. My question is to both panelists, do you think term limits are going to help the Republican Party take over Congress?
Well, I think the Republicans who sponsored this think so and hope so. The idea of being on the opposite side of an issue from Ralph Nader and Jerry Brown really appeals to me, and I thank you for that. You are welcome to them, Bill.
Thanks a lot. I'm speechless. I don't know. Obviously, if you've got institutions predominantly one party, and if people are many seats are suddenly opened up, but I think you can make an argument that if incumbency is a big advantage, you can make an argument that term limits would help Republicans. I don't honestly believe that it was a partisan plot. I mean, certainly gerrymandering, for example, reapportionment is much more important as a device, if you will, than term limits. Many of the people who would be thrown out by term limits have utterly safe seats. I mean, that's one reason they're there so long, is that they're overwhelmingly Democratic or Republican districts. So, it's not clear that there'd be a huge amount of turnover. I don't really think that's the key argument for it. It never has been. Simply that. That is partisan turnover is certainly the key argument for it, or even partisan competitiveness. I think it'd be better if there were more competitive congressional districts, if that's an argument for perhaps doing reapportionment somewhat differently from we do. But the argument for term limits was an argument against sort of excessive incumbency per se, not incumbency of one party or the other.
I have a question over here.
Yes, for Bill Kristol. Bill, when people earlier in the century were dissatisfied with the way senators were operating, the solution was a constitutional amendment to get senators popularly elected. This was supposed to make senators closer to the people. What it did, of course, was to damage federalism greatly and make, ultimately, senators closer to interest groups in Washington. With that background and in the spirit of the Federalist Papers, have you considered the real other factors or motives and ambitions? Have you considered, first of all, going after by statute a limitation or an abolition of retirement funds, pension funds, for congressmen? That could be done by statute and certainly is a motivator. Secondly, regarding the Iron Triangle, have you considered, given our technology, moving congressional offices back to the states? Why does the House of Representatives have to meet constantly in Washington? Could it be that some people who might run for office have no desire to spend their life in Washington and to see their family destroyed? And maybe we would get a better quality if you took those kind of legislative steps that look at what ambitions are involved, rather than such a radical step as a constitutional amendment.
Well, I do think that this is an amendment, though, that this is whether it's legislation or an amendment that does try to address the issue that the Federalists are so concerned about, motives and ambitions in the sentence, and tries to think about whether limited terms would in fact change the balance of motives and ambitions and interests out there in a way that's good for the political system. So I don't think it's dissimilar in that respect from what you're talking about. I'm not so certain, I'm no expert on it, that the constitutional amendment requiring direct election of senators was a mistake or led to a greater dominance of interest groups. It seems to me a lot of those senators who were appointed by the state legislatures were pretty much in the pocket of interest groups in the mid and late 19th century, and I saw this as a historical question. The retirement funds proposal is fine, but it would have to be passed by Congress, presumably, which I think is, it could happen if there were a popular outcry. But we've seen this with pay raises and whatnot. There is a popular outcry, but the trouble with that is you get a sort of temporary reversal for Congress. But I mean, A, it's often a somewhat trivial issue, and B, it then gets reversed in turn in the dead of night by a bipartisan agreement to take care of each other. So I do think you do need to address it at a slightly deeper level than, you know, congressional offices or even the congressional pay, and really look at the fundamental character of the congressional career. I mean, the thing about term limits that's interesting, and this is why it is fairly radical, though, is that it really changes, I think, the whole dynamics of individual politicians' careers, and thereby changes the dynamics, of the institution in a fairly serious way, for better or worse.
Normally, the conventional wisdom is that if you want people to retire, you increase rather than decrease their pension. I just want to point out there is a kind of an axiom of human behavior under there which suggests that that's probably right.
There's several laws in judicial retirement. I know in many of the states that if the judge stays, for example, used to be the law here in Texas, if the judge stayed past 70, his pension was cut in half. So he had a big incentive to retire at 70. And that's a factor that has been used, and it has worked.
Yeah, that's probably one way to do it, although you'd run up pretty close against Paul B. McCormick if you tried something like that. I have, for a long time, very much liked the idea, and about 20 years ago advocated a retirement system for Congress, but the way I read Paul B. McCormick, they just sort of going by took a swipe at it, and I think they would have to reverse Paul in order to do it.
Maybe we could only pay congressmen if they do retire. That would address the voters.
Well, you remember in the federal system, it was pretty disgraceful at the top. There was no retirement provision for Supreme Court justices, and it was probably keeping some of them job longer than they wanted to be on the job.
What explains the current crew?
Ronald Reagan, mostly. Oh, we have a man in the audience who can speak up.
Just a question to a point made by Mr. Crystal about the culture of Congress, and I wonder, what of the citizen legislator, the agrarian sort of model, the Jefferson model of the legislator, who still went home to plant the crops, still lived in his district, still suffered with the rest of us the effect of the laws passed in Washington. I think the real impetus for term limits today, aside from the partisan impetus, is the notion that congressmen get to Washington and end up becoming creatures of Washington, no longer having to abide by the regulations which they seem to ceaselessly create, exempting themselves from civil rights provisions, employment discrimination provisions, etc., never really having to run the business which once made them money and gave them the power which they now wield. What of that culture of Congress? How would it change, and would it be more like the culture of Congress envisioned by the Federalists, by Publius, at the time of the framing?
No, that's very well put, and perhaps, puts a little better than I did the point I was trying to make there, which I never tried to return to in reading the paragraph in Federalist 57. I mean, one of the most striking things about the current Congress is it does exactly that which Madison thought it was almost inconceivable that a Congress and a democracy would do, exempt itself from the laws it passes. And that is very revealing about the separation of both the distance it feels from its constituents or from the citizenry, and its ability to simply get away with exempting itself from those laws. And that is, it's very revealing of the culture of Congress. And I do think we're not going to go all the way back to agrarian legislators or, you know, a month or two, a year, but you would have a very, very different culture and a different perspective in Congress if you had businessmen who have been successful deciding that it was worth it to join the House, try to go to the House of Representatives for 6, 8, 10, 12 years. They wouldn't be powerless. And conversely, that you couldn't really, didn't make much sense to simply climb up the greasy totem pole of the Appropriations Committee, so that eventually you become subcommittee chairman and channel funds to the interest groups that were dominant in your district. So I do think one of the strongest arguments for term limits is the way in which it would change the whole sociology, if you will, of Congress, or the culture in which congressmen operate.
Can I just briefly address the Grandma Moses imagery? 2% of the population of the United States now lives on farms. These people are not going to go back to the farm. But the second proposition seems to me even more suspect, and that is we have a situation where what is being complained of is that these people get reelected at high rates, and secondly, that they're out of touch. It seems to me that if you pursue those two propositions relentlessly enough, you will have to give up one or the other.
I really think that is just facile and not the case. I mean, it is true. It is an empirically true description of the current system, or at least of the way many Americans feel about the current system, that they both feel that for various reasons, they either don't have the ability to replace the current congressman, or they have a lot at stake, given the seniority and incumbency situation in keeping the current congressman, that they do feel they're out of touch. And it's just too easy to say, well, these two seem to be, in some technical sense, in contradiction, and they both can't be true. And it's not Grandma Moses, it's successful businessmen and lawyers and university presidents and all kinds of people out in the country who really now have no incentive, I think, to run for Congress because of the current institutional structure, among other reasons.
Take one over here on the right. These are not necessarily reflective of anything but location.
Thank you. In my home state of Virginia, the governor is not allowed to succeed himself in office, but he is allowed, after sitting out of term, to run again. And I was wondering if such a proposal or some variation thereof were proposed. Mr. Crystal, would you be willing to accept such a compromise, and would a variation on that address some of your concerns, Professor Poulter?
Yeah, I think most of the term limits proposals are only proposals for consecutive terms, so I think that would be fine.
In California, there's a lifetime ban on state legislators serving up to their quota and no more. Just out of curiosity, what are former governors of Virginia doing? Are they running for the Senate? Well, Jerry Belisle is not. I think he's just going back to a law firm. You know, so presumably that's as close to working right, I think, from your the point of view, as they would be.
No, it's executive branch, or somewhat different.
Yeah. Well, there are different arguments for the executive branch. We probably ought to service them. Executives own bureaucracies, which makes it a little different. So, I have a question here.
Yes, Gary Lawson from Northwestern Law School. This is for Nelson Polsby. Let's assume that you're absolutely right about term limits, and that considered by themselves, they are a bad idea. A colleague of mine, with whom you have some acquaintance, Dan Polsby, has recently written on what may be the most troubling process problem with American politics, and that's the ability of gerrymanders to render elections irrelevant. Now, the experience of the last 30 years pretty much demonstrates the difficulty of crafting direct constitutional regulations of the districting process. Could it be the case that term limits, unappetizing as they are the best available remedy for the otherwise irremediable problem of the gerrymander? Defend term limits not directly on the merits, but as the best available solution to the gerrymander problem.
I'm not entirely at one with my brother Polsby on this issue. Term limits is an attempt permanently to maim the legislature, the constitutional body of the United States. Gerrymandering at worst is for 10 years only. And I do think that that makes it fundamentally less damaging thing. We've had some examples, it seems to me, of manipulation of districts to the advantage of one party or another, and they have the characteristic of decaying. Sometimes predictions don't pan out the way the people who rigged it thought. But most of all, at very worst, even Phil Burton couldn't safeguard districts past that 10-year limitation. And so it's fundamentally, it seems to me, better to work on the politics of that by far than to do the kind of institutional harm a permanent ban would create in the term limits situation.
Let me ask you, how is it that you can say that this last 10 years, aren't the people who are the beneficiaries of it in control of redrawing the district?
No, not always. It's typical.
Not always,
no.
I guess, but I mean, what about most of the time?
Well, not even most of the time. The answer is not most of the time. State of California, which had the worst example of that, the Republicans wisely put a lot of effort into nominating an electable governor and elected a governor. 10 years ago, all three of the relevant bodies, Assembly, Senate, and governorship, were held by the Democrats, not this time. Therefore, Pete Wilson used his position in order to make sure that the legislature did not write the boundaries. In fact, special masters did under three retired judges, as the Constitution calls for. In any event, even so, if you're talking about congressional districting, the state legislatures always do that at the very worst. So it isn't the same people, and in fact, as you can see, there are ways of dealing in the political arena with that problem.
Okay, my question, which you sort of alluded to a little bit, is on the state legislature side. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal recently about that nobody wants to run for the state legislature in California. They're having a lot of trouble finding people because of the term limitation. I guess I was going to ask Mr. Crystal and also you, what is your feeling? Is it a differentiated model at the state legislative level, or would you apply the same sort of viewpoints?
Well, since it's happened under my nose, let me take a first crack at it. In the first place, it was done by initiative, and the U.S. Constitution hasn't got an initiative in it, so there's a difference there. In the second place, what they did was not only put a lifetime ban on constitutional offices, and mind you, you can hold on constitutional offices, they said no pension for work done as a state legislator, and they reduced the staff available to the state legislature by about 40% immediately. Subsequent to that, the office of chief lobbyist for the California Medical Association fell open, and on the short list, four of the five members of the short list were sitting legislators. My view is that it's the only people who are conceivably likely to offer themselves for the state legislature in the future under those rather severe circumstances not contemplated by the congressional proposals I've heard is the old, that is to say people who've completed their careers elsewhere and want to do this as a kind of a public service hobby. The old, the rich, who don't have to worry about feeding their families, having a pension, having a career, and the bought. That is to say, people who make relationships with interest groups.
Well, I don't know the details of California system. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the different states that have passed different forms of term limitations, both in terms of length and provisions for being able to run later, or pensions, or salaries, or other such things. There's probably a case if you're going to limit terms for having, I would say, rather more generous salaries, since people are giving up, you know, going somewhere where they can't make a career, so to speak. It's going to fall off one day. And I think, in fact, there'd be popular support for that if they didn't think they were, simply people were feathering their own nest. But we will have, one good thing is that we will have some empirical evidence, presumably, at state levels of how some of these different forms of term limitation work.
Professor Polsby. There seems to be a lot of routine dishonesty in politics. Elected officials taking positions, explaining their views, making assertions in ways in public that they very freely admit in private conversation they don't believe or really not so. It seems to be somewhat more casual on the job lying when you're in politics and in most professions. I wonder if you agree with that observation, and if you do, what do you think the effect on someone's personality and character is to do that day in and day out over a long period of years? Do you think serving Congress tends to be an ennobling experience or a corrupting one? Did John Dingell start out that way? And is this relevant to the question on the table?
No, I think it is. I should have said, this is a position I've held since the early 60s, I must tell you, that life itself is not a terribly ennobling experience for large numbers of people. And there are some characteristics, it seems to me, of elective politics, which test the character all the time. One of them is the fact that the very careers of these people are dependent upon convincing large masses of people who are basically inattentive and ignorant about their work, that they should be supported. Now, the inattentiveness of the electorates, which is a fundamental fact of life that these people have to deal with, means that you have to develop, sales shortcuts of various kinds. The idea, for example, of defending a complex proposition that you know to be truer than the simple proposition that your opponent is hawking around discourages many conscientious people. My favorite example of this was, you may remember the presidential debate in San Francisco in 1976, in which Jimmy Carter assured the nation that he would not conduct diplomacy in secret. Gerald Ford, who was simply not an eloquent man, and knew that explaining how you conduct diplomacy in the 20th century, as the best of my knowledge, any other century, requires some confidentiality and sometimes some secrecy, simply gave up and said, "Well, I won't do it either." Now, in my opinion, that did not damage Gerald Ford's character. What it did was, it caused all the knowledgeable people who witnessed that to face once again the reality that some of the conditions under which elective politicians in a democracy in which politics is not at the center of everybody's attention live under constraints, and some of these constraints are wearing. Corresponding constraints of other sorts exist for other occupations, but there's no doubt in my mind that that is a problem that these people have to face. I think those of us who are privileged to obtain more knowledge about these things ought, it seems to me, to be more sympathetic to the broad range of some of the constraints that these people operate under. I don't mind, in other words, throwing dead cats, but I would much prefer that they be that we consider ourselves more constrained in what we allow ourselves in the way of criticism of people who opt for public service.
I just say one word about that. I think the question and the answer are important because the spirit of the Federalist and of the understanding that, you know, democracy does not simply produce all good things, and that one of the classic corruptions of democracy is the kind of routine dishonesty or the desire to please or a certain desire to pander that is simply endemic to a democratic form of government. But I do think it is therefore that one can both, I think one would hope that politicians would resist it, hope that the citizenry would not demand it, and try and also understand it when it happens. I don't get excessively indignant about it. I do think, however, one can ask. I mean, it is a reasonable criterion upon which to judge, to say, an issue like term limits, to ask, do people, when they serve longer, is their character improved, is their judgment improved, is their tendency to pander more or less, is there a tendency to pander more or less? And again, one could even try to do sort of quasi-empirical studies of, first, second, third term congressional candidates against 10th or 20th term congressional candidates. But it's a reasonable criterion. One reason judges have life tenures that we think that, in fact, the judicial temperament sort of becomes more ingrained, in a sense, over the years, not less. And the question would be whether the sort of virtues of leadership in a democracy are cultivated by the current system over the years in Congress or the vices.
This is addressed to both speakers, please. One of the earlier speakers described the Federalist Papers as this wonderful machine which is perfectly balanced, and some people choose to describe the Constitution the same way. Of course, if that was ever true, both of those have been since replaced in so many different parts from different eras that we no longer have the same creature that had that perfect balance as ever did. So I'm wondering what the relevance is of the Federalist Papers to your proposal at all, whether it's simply a use to put there. But to Mr. Crystal, let me suggest that there is language in 52 and 53, which I'll quote, which might be helpful to your position. The greater the power is, the shorter should be its duration. And this again adverts to the idea of the federal legislation being watched and controlled by the several collateral legislatures, and that being an essential part of that scheme, which of course a constitutional amendment is wiped out. So maybe you'd like to remove one of those previous constitutional amendments to get back to the original, if that's your direction. So I'm wondering, in terms of being a conservative, if you want to get back to the what the Federalist Papers of the original Constitution had, there are other ways. You essentially have the experimentation of 100 years or so to look at before the Constitution was re-amended, and I'm wondering why you try that instead of, basically conservatives normally don't like to tinker with fundamental documents, if that's what you're talking about.
Yes, we'll have another question, and we'll ask y'all for some closing.
Well, I'll be brief. We just can't get back to the original document, and in some respects one wouldn't want to. Some of those amendments were awfully good things for the country. Obviously, especially the ones ending the terrible compromise that barred the original document, the compromise of slavery. I tried in my very brief remarks in the spirit of taking into account some of the developments, a tiny bit of the developments since the Federalists, and one of the most important being the growth of the federal government, the welfare state, and all that goes with it, to argue that in a sense, if they had seen a federal legislature with the kind of power that federal legislature has now, in a system of this shape that we see now, so very, very different from that, they anticipated in the one they set up, they might well have been much more sympathetic to term limits for federal legislators than they in fact were. I accept the quotation as a helpful one in that respect. The federal legislators have much more power than now, than the Federalists, the authors of the Federalists thought they would, or intended they would, and in that respect, the argument for limiting the duration of their terms becomes perhaps stronger than it was in 1789.
Take one final question, and then we'll call on our panelists here for a closing comment.
My question's for Professor Polsby. He mentioned that 98% of congressmen are reelected and suggested that this is because, in general, they're serving their constituents well. It seems to me that given the constraints of the system as it is now without term limitations, this is somewhat true in that constituents elect and re-elect again their congressmen because they know the more senior, the more powerful their congressmen are, the better those congressmen will be at diverting the maximum amount of federal taxpayer funds into their districts. It seems to me that the best argument for term limitations is not so much protecting people from their own congressmen whom they can get rid of sort of each 2 years at their disposal, but to protect constituents from other people's congressmen who will transfer their funds to us, to other constituents of their districts. And this problem is particularly acute in recent years, given that more funds are transferred by the federal government each year, and the constituent in his district knows that congressmen in other districts will attempt to do that as much as they can, and they also know that the more senior the congressman is, the more adept he will be at doing that, and therefore they are basically obliged, in order to have the most powerful congressman, to continue to elect that congressman. And I don't know how there's a solution nationally. It's the same reason that you wondered why we have more, perhaps, Democratic congressmen yet Republican presidents.
Okay, well, if I understand what you said, you agree with my general proposition that competence increases with experience. At least I heard that. I also heard a general axiom that it isn't the members who are so awful, it's the people who are intractably greedy. And I quite agree with you that it's very hard to see how you can reach that by simply cutting off their representatives, who will presumably be replaced by people who will be equally inclined to behave in the way you suggest. So it's just not a, it seems to me it's, this particular set of measures is simply a wash in terms of the underlying problem as you identify.
I think we'd better close our questions. Nelson, would you end up with a closing comment?
No. Just two very good points. One, a very small one, that Nelson mentioned that Senator Dan Quayle, somehow, according to his book about him by political scientist Richard Fennell, didn't hit his stride or something until the sixth year. In fact, Dick Fennell's book shows that he, after serving in the House 4 years, in his second year in the Senate, co-authored the Job Training Partnership Act, probably his quite an impressive accomplishment for a junior, very junior senator. He sort of created the AROS, the Israeli SDI, the AROS system in his fifth year in the Senate, forced the administration to revise the INF treaty in the seventh year in the Senate, and of course was moving on to bigger and better things in this after 8 years in the Senate. So I think, in fact, his career arc, as does that of others, Phil Graham and many, many others, suggests that you can do an awful lot as quite a junior member of the Senate, and junior members of the House could do quite a lot if they weren't so encumbered by the system of seniority and incumbency, which term limitations is designed to change. The broad point, I'll try to put this clearly and simply, I think, in fact, the debate, I'd say Nelson Pope's attitude, if I characterize it, a little bit unfairly, but only with the routine dishonesty that those of us in Washington have.
You've been there too long, Bill.
That's true, yeah.
Don't you wish there was a law preventing you from being there?
There is. It's the only elections. It's Nelson's attitude, sort of exasperation that we have to debate this gimmick, which really has been drawn out for partisan reasons, in which would thoughtlessly damage the system in a very fundamental way. It is a radical reform, but I suppose where we differ is that I think that precisely this kind of debate, and I'm willing, to be convinced that term limitations is not the best or even one of the best reforms. If I had a list of things to work on that I might devote myself to, I'm not certain. But I think this kind of debate is actually the discussion is very important. So I do think, and maybe we differ, that the system is sufficiently off course, and I also think that the American people think the system is sufficiently off course, which is itself a dangerous fact in a democracy, that this kind of systemic reform is worth considering and worth debating, and that one can't simply cheerfully say to, gee, we should get different candidates, or this must be what the people want, and therefore it can't really be a problem if you're reelecting these people. So I think in a funny way, the debate about term limits is two things. It's a debate about people who think it's a good idea and people who think it's a bad idea. But perhaps at a deeper level, it's a debate between people who want to think about systemic changes, of which term limitations is one example,
that would change the rules of the game to correct what they, or in this case we, see as major deficiencies of current liberal welfare states or interest group modern politics, modern democratic politics, and those who either don't think that the current system needs that much, that fundamental reform, or are, I suppose, very, very skeptical that any systemic reform would do much good. So I think, in a way, as I say, there are two debates, one, term limits versus non-term limits, and the other, sort of systemic reform in general, the need to consider it seriously, and the utility of considering it seriously. Because there is a kind of educational process for the citizenry here, trying to think through what we want from our Congress and what we want from our government, as opposed to those who think it's too dangerous to really even consider seriously.
Thank you. Nelson.
Don't trespass too much on the former Attorney General's time. I think that was a very good, graceful statement. Your characterization of my attitude is roughly correct. I hope next time we see one another, we'll be on the same side.
Thank you.